This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Amen with even 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
This was a difficult morning for some of us. I think it must have been Monday when I was in Sacramento that I talked about the four sights, Buddha's four sights. That wasn't here, was it? I haven't talked about that here. Okay, so that was in Sacramento. And among other things, I said that everyone has those. Everyone has those encounters with old age, sickness, death, in a way that is very startling at some point in one's life. It is one of the many aspects of Shakyamuni Buddha's life that is just like ours. Even though, as far as I know, nobody here grew up as a prince or princess, but in a way we did, in that for most of us, the environment of our childhood was fairly carefully looked after. I certainly didn't grow up under circumstances where no one was paying attention to me or ignoring my well-being. And some of us may have had that experience. By and large, people in this country, the sphere of their upbringing is tended pretty carefully. And then at some point, the way things are intrudes. And we could lose a parent or be seriously hurt ourselves, or have the difficult experience of watching someone we love get very, very elderly and very frail and weak and ill, and realize that that's actually, this is how life unfolds. So Shakyamuni Buddha's story is about how one guy, anyway, turned the energy of those encounters into the energy of seeking to understand. And out of the energy, seeking to understand was born a tradition of, we say practice, but a tradition of relating to the world and our lives so that the spirit, the human spirit, is freed rather than cramped or imprisoned. It's very common for sentient beings to live in such a way that they, as we get older, we get painted into a smaller and smaller corner. And without this insight into what's actually happening, we can come to believe that we actually are imprisoned. But some of us heard the story of Buddha's insight, his deep scrutiny of things as they actually happen. And he noticed that the pivot of suffering is how we understand ourselves to be in the world on a very, very deep level. And the teaching indicates that sentient beings all have this capacity to see correctly. We say, you know, Buddha nature or something. It means the capacity to apprehend reality accurately. And the way that works is the more accurate our apprehension of reality becomes, the more our suffering decreases. However, it does not entirely go away. Even the celebrated koanista Robert Aitken said, as far as he could see, there may be an irreducible amount of dukkha in life that we just have to get used to. An irreducible kernel of unease. And yet, it is helpful to bring that kernel down to its minimal size, whatever that is. This morning, I was very sick, actually, a very, very nasty migraine. And unfortunately, the Shuso was also ill, and there was no one to do anything, so I had to get up and wander around looking like Night of the Living Dead, which is, I'm sure, exactly what I looked like, and I felt terrible about that, but couldn't seem to help it. My inner state was translating to my outer appearance in a way that I couldn't seem to do much about. And there was some encouragement in noticing that that didn't change the teaching really at all. In a way, maybe that made it possible to get out of bed rather than call for the servants and say, cancel all my appointments, I'm not getting out of bed. which I didn't think I could do, so I didn't. Also, there don't happen to be any servants, so that makes it all the more difficult. No little maids or footmen with a silver tray ready to take your note downstairs and say, "The Reverend will not be appearing today." But there were some people around, so we got some stuff done. I once again had the, I confess, not exactly welcome experience of practicing, you know, trying to be somewhat upright in the midst of quite considerable discomfort. And it seemed like in our early sitting, every few minutes I'd notice I was kind of doing this. Or this, I'd have to straighten up again. You know, just to remind myself that, as Suzukiro, she said, there's no problem with suffering Buddha. That's not a problem. That's how things work. And the more deeply we commit ourselves to responding to the energy of bodhicitta, the more profoundly our life is transformed. Bodhicitta, of course, is the recognition that there is awakening. That one could be such a person as to be able to help people find out about this awakening. And that, in fact, the great ideal is to commit, to vow all our life energy, the energy of all of our lives, be they many or few, to that, to passing on that gift. A while ago, I noticed that sometimes in the midst of my own suffering, I'll sit in my darkened chamber and mutter dark things. And I noticed that some of the dark things I mutter were dark things that I overheard my father mutter in the midst of his suffering. I thought, oh, how about that? Did I inherit that somehow? Those dark mutterings? He, unfortunately, he had no practice he could recognize, let's put it that way. I won't say he had no practice, but he had none that he could recognize. So there was a lot of darkness there. And not much opportunity to bear witness to the light. So my own suffering this morning was greatly reduced by an injection of some medicine, which is one of those medicines that nobody exactly knows what it does, except it seems to help. It is entirely non-recreational, to reassure you of that fact. Apart from the sting of the needle, there is no apparent effect except after, well, half an hour to 60 minutes, the attack begins to wane. So I was very grateful about that, and also I was very grateful that before that, when we were having our breakfast at the dining room table, and I was still at the mercy of the demons, I was able to invite a mind of gratitude inspired by the fact that there was food to eat and people to eat food with. I was glad that, you know, that still worked. Look at that. There is a grateful mind. Of course, the demons immediately tore it apart. But then it was pretty straightforward to invite grateful mind again. And I noticed that there were as many grateful minds as there were demons. So I thought that was a pretty good arrangement. And the inspiration to practice in that way comes from Shakyamuni Buddha's awakening and insight, which now you all are party to as well. And there was some other stuff going on the past couple of days that also felt like suddenly coming upon something frightening and ugly. Another sight, if you will, like Buddha encountering the old person, the sick person, the dead body, and in a later version, the happy mendicant. I was always a little suspicious of that one, but that does sound like the kind of thing to kind of tack on later. And then he saw the happy mendicant, which means makes the story, gives it a little upbeat twist there at the end, so you know, people don't get too gloomy about the three sights, which were less than inspiring, at least at first. And so this body reacted with fear and anger and despair. It was fascinating to watch all of those phenomena karmically triggered and conditioned arise and display themselves and pass away as they do. And to find myself muttering darkly in the tradition of my family. So I guess what I'm saying once again is that It's so great that Suzuki Roshi is so eminently quotable. Many little wise sayings and aphorisms somehow came out of his teaching, although he did not, as I recall, present them as such. Certainly not to me. But, you know, he said, really, practice only makes a little difference. But that difference is extremely important. And I must say, I find that to be true over and over again. Of course, over the millennia, since Buddha's time, people have thought up many different ways of talking about and presenting really the practices and the philosophizing which have arisen around this jewel of insight. And yet another koanista par excellence, this one, the master Linji, Yixuan, famous master Rinzai from the Tang Dynasty, in what I suspect may have been one of his quieter talks, just told people that he was telling them about the three bodies of Buddha, and he said, those are your own mind, Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya. Those are your own mind, its purity, its discriminating vision, its peace in the face of non-differentiation. There is no Buddha body other than your mind. And this, in a way, is Shakyamuni Buddha's warm hand extending from the 5th century BCE to us with an invitation to allow our own insight to be nurtured. To find how it is that this mind, which is the three bodies of Buddha, can be expressed in our life. So I promise to continue to invite mind of gratitude, mind of non-attachment, mind of respect, even in those dark places. So if you see me muttering darkly, you can very gently, if you wouldn't mind, you can inquire, are you able to recall that a mind of gratitude can be invited now? And then I hope I will have the grace to say, why, thank you for reminding me. I had actually forgotten for a moment there. So dark were things. So beset was I by the sights, be they three, four, or thousands. So next week is already Thanksgiving. The week after, we start our retreat. Just to remind you, you're all invited to drop by. join us for some sitting. Our retreats aren't as long as some of the ones that are also occurring around that same time. But quite a while ago, I realized that a shorter retreat is not a deformed longer retreat. A shorter retreat has its own joys and graces. So I hope you will take the opportunity to enter that space that we will all be creating together. Enter and leave quietly. And enjoy and appreciate receiving the touch of Shakyamuni's warm hand from so long ago. And as you know, around here we call that just sitting. That's the name we give it. But what's in a name after all? If you'd like to ask some questions, please feel free. Yes.
How, I guess, is the question. Yes, it's almost in my fifth decade, I realized that it's almost moving from light to darkness, or darkness to light, and it's just back and forth. You know, there's many, many darkness moments, and then you find light, and you seek the light, and then you're in the light, and then you go to a darkness, and then you look for light again. So it's just back and forth, and I felt like I've been fortunate and blessed to have found the practice to get out of the darkness. But I guess my question is, the question to you is, as a mother of a young child, you just want the best for them, you want them to find a tool to get out of the darkness, to go toward the light.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all, you know, in this room have been so fortunate to have the tool. But I think eventually she'll find her own way to get out of the darkness, but you don't want them to. How do you teach a child the tool?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I would want to say that what we teach isn't exactly a way to get out of the dark. There's lots of ways to do that, and some of them are really a bad idea, and some of them are okay. But the teaching as we have it is, as many of you will recall, that right in the dark there is light. So that's another way that Buddha's profound insight is dressed in language, this teaching that right in darkness is the light, which means, so it's not a tool to hear that you don't have to go anywhere, you don't have to get away from anything. That's a teaching that enters the body-mind, and depending on factors that we cannot control, has what effect it has. A child is an unfolding masterpiece of karma, among other things. And from my point of view anyway, not having been a child, but not having been a parent, the best teaching is that of example. So for the child to be able to see that, without, of course, they won't, maybe years before they can verbalize anything, but they will have some sense that once the child can recognize, oh, there's some dark and there's some light. Oh, look, even when mom is in the dark, there's some light there. She doesn't sneak into the kitchen and grab the bottle of vodka and empty it down her throat in order to get away from something. There's actually, there, right in that darkness, there is light. And she demonstrates that by not really going anywhere, just being still in the midst of what's arising. And this can be demonstrated, as Dogen says, the best way is with the body. Demonstrate with this body. And nobody knows ahead of time what that's going to look like. But with our minds blessed by this teaching of right in darkness, there is light. New possibilities become available, both for ourselves and others. And then, of course, the Chinese, being the Chinese, they came right back and said, oh, and by the way, right in light, there is darkness, which is another beautifully succinct way of framing Shakyamuni's insight. That's using the Chinese idiom, the Chinese aesthetic. Very different from the Indian, but so concise and to the point, and yet also so poetic. So these are these gems that we've inherited, and the best way to pass them on to another generation is with the body somehow. Does that make any sense to you at all?
Perfect.
Yes.
All right. I heard in sort of an interesting way when I was on a vacation in Taos. Because one of the teachings that I think can really annoy people, is that every day is a good day.
Yes.
People hear that like a sign. It's like,
it's really
in
annoying.
A Hallmark card. Uh-huh. It's actually for when I was working at the emergency department case management, I had above my desk in Chinese characters because you can't have it in English. People just not get it. So, but anyway, so we were in Taos and went to the hot tub for the second time in the morning or something, telling that to the woman who was cleaning the rooms. And she said, why not? She said, have as much fun as possible. I thought, that's the same teaching, actually. Because it's just not hedonistic advice, it's a challenge. Go ahead, see how much fun you can actually have if you really apply yourself. It won't be as much as you think.
Well, that could be another mind of the teaching, actually. Have as much fun as you possibly can.
Yeah.
But keep your eyes open, and watch how that works. And maybe your definition of fun will be transformed in ways that you never guessed. So, if we can bring that much openness to teachings such as have as much fun as you can, there will be some benefit for sure. And it may be more palatable than, don't forget, every day's a good day. Yes?
Just to remind people who haven't heard it, but there's a song saying, not having fun to practice, maybe you should try something like that.
Could you say it again?
If you're not having fun,
if you're not
practice,
having fun,
maybe you should.
You should try something else. Well, he has a point.
Yeah. Philip Whalen said fun is highly overrated.
Fun is highly overrated. he lived that truth.
So, Philip.
That's only for half a minute.
Was there a hand? Yeah.
Abigail, thank you for your talk. You mentioned despair, and I wonder how to address despair, hopelessness, futility. Because it's not really suffering, it's sort of. It is suffering, but it's an altogether different thing.
Mm. Well, it is. It is a quality of suffering or a type of suffering that does tend to make any constructive action very, very difficult, if not impossible. But with all of these difficult arisings, and in fact, with even the pleasant and joyful arisings, the great effort is not to reify it, not to actually brand it as a state that I'm stuck in, like being stuck in a burning house or something. It's very easy for our karmic habits to make it seem as though this despair is like a cell and I'll never find the key to the door and I'll never get out. And that kind of reification is can be interrupted. And one of, I think, Buddha's great insights was to see that, oh, these sorts of mental creations can be interrupted. And one way you do that is by gently and with balance resisting the momentum that these arisings have to push us in some direction or other, you know, make us run. You know, we actually don't have to do that. We can stand there and, as they say in Chan, face into the wind, right, without going anywhere. And that is very difficult sometimes, very, very difficult. That wind is so bitter and so cold, and you know, sometimes we crumple. And then there's Suzuki Roshi again reminding us, you know, when you fall down on the ground, that's where you get up, right there. And this is another precious teaching. So I guess the most important point and the most general point is don't reify. And when you're reifying, notice that you're doing that. And just noticing that changes the energy already. And the subtle processes in the body-mind that are happening when there are currents of despair, and they take a while to dissipate, just like clouds in the sky. So it's important to be able to go back again and again to this practice of no reification. Let it be, just let it be. And if in our lives we've also had the opportunity to experience this body-mind upright in stillness, that will be a tremendous resource. That will be a deep, tissue-deep reminder that we don't have to go with that flow. You don't have to. Does that click at all for you? Yes.
My experience with that was with, you know, something. No, you do have to go with that flow. You do have to. You've lost sight of it. You're not enlightened. You're not awakened. All your practice is gone. And you just look at that for about 10 seconds. You're like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, but you do have to have that experience of.
Yeah. As some people, you know, the Tibetans would say the good roots of practice are what give rise to that moment of, oh, wait a minute. Right? And people may not have had any formal so-called practice at all in their lives, and yet they'll still, at some point, they'll have that that noticing of like, oh, wait a second, maybe it isn't the way I thought. Maybe things don't work that way. Maybe I don't have to do that. whether they're Buddhists or something else is really irrelevant. In some traditions, of course, that's called grace. And that, they say, is available to everyone, freely available. Tendo-san, did you have a question?
I was a little shocked by what I thought you might have been saying. I was thinking of the Third Noble Truth.
Yes.
And the cessation of suffering.
Yes.
Along with the Aitken statement of there's probably all of these. I was also reading upstairs a little bit in the cloud of unknowing, and I feel like this phrase I read was a bit like there's always maybe a little bit of irreducible suffering, which is, you take the hard road to heaven or the comfortable road to hell. But,
yeah. Did you want to inquire further how serious I was about this irreducible lump of suffering?
Sure.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess I'm pretty serious about it. Buddha did not teach that in order to have a life that is has vitality and is suffused with insight, you do not have to get rid of every last shred of suffering. He did not teach that. So I wouldn't be surprised myself if, in one sense or another, all of you who are here today are what's called stream enterers, meaning you are in the stream towards complete awakening, and you will never fall out. I'm guessing that that's probably true. And how that will unfold, of course, who knows? One day or another, each of you will have your own, they say in Sanskrit, your own vyakarana, your own prediction to Buddhahood. Someone will come along and say, you, in such and such a time and such a place, will be a Buddha named such and such. And you will have, your Buddha land will look like such and such. This will happen to all of you one day. So, congratulations. And because you're stream enterers, you don't have to worry so much. You are able to be handed the hissing poisonous serpent called every day is a good day, and actually do something useful with it. So, I guess we're going to try and celebrate our stream entry a little bit more today, for a little while anyway. And I forget, do we have noon service? It's kind of interesting. The calendar and the schedule and stuff, I didn't really draw those up. Other people did. So it's like, I don't know what's in them half the time. So we may or we may not have a noon service.
I think what was provided to me from a board meeting that was from a memory from some notes at a chanting.
Noon chanting.
Yeah.
Okay.
But
it's very short, and then we can have tea and cookies. So you're all welcome to stay or carry on with your lives in the wide world. Thank you all for your practice.
May our intention equally extend to every being.